Welcome to The Hurt by Dr. Meera Kirpaker and Dr. Alopi Patel. We are the Female Pain Docs. This is a platform to contribute to the public discourse on women's pain and general health. We are here to empower women and men to engage in the advancement of their health with discussions of evidence-based medicine, unconventional topics, lifestyle modifications, and more.
The views contained in this podcast are our personal views and do not represent the views of our institutions. This does not substitute medical advice. Please be evaluated by a physician if necessary.
Welcome back to The Hurt by the Female Pain Docs. Today on The Hurt, we are honored to welcome Dr. Maria Sophocles, a nationally recognized clinician, educator, and one of the trusted voices in women's sexual health and menopause care. From her academic roots at Duke University and Jefferson Medical College to her groundbreaking work at Women's Healthcare of Princeton, Dr. Sophocles is a vanguard in menopause management and female sexual health. Dr. Sophocles has spent decades at the intersection of pain, hormones, intimacy, and advocacy, treating patients while also challenging the systems that have historically minimized women's symptoms and suffering. She is also the author of the upcoming book, The Bedroom Gap, which takes a hard, honest look at why women's sexual pain, desire, and satisfaction are so dismissed. And she also talks about what closing that gap truly requires. Her work pushes all of us to ask uncomfortable but necessary questions about medicine, relationships, and the cultural narratives that shape whose pain is believed and whose pleasure is prioritized. We're thrilled to have her here. Welcome, Dr. Sophocles.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here, and you articulated that so beautifully. I'm really grateful. Thank you for sharing what I feel inside and why I had to write this book and what I've done for three decades. It really is lovely to hear you encapsulate it and understand it.
And that's quite the time to have dedicated your life and your career to such an important topic. There were so many areas in medicine historically that have been underappreciated, undertaught, under-researched. What initially drew you to your area of work? Was there like some sort of recognition that, you know what, there's something about menopause that just doesn't get this attention?
Yeah, it was actually a very natural and organic evolution. I started my clinical career as an OBGYN, a board-certified OBGYN, and I had great training. I trained in Baltimore at a very prestigious place to deliver babies, to do surgeries, to diagnose cancer, all the traditional things in OBGYN. And I began practicing in private practice and felt I was really well-trained. And I was really well-trained in certain things, but I didn't realize that I hadn't had almost any training in menopause. And as I started seeing midlife and menopausal-aged women, and they would present with myriad symptoms like palpitations and brain fog and anxiety and depression, I felt very incompetent, very incapable of understanding why they were having all these symptoms, joint pain and burning of their mouth and feeling of ants crawling on their skin. And at first, I literally did the worst thing I possibly could, which I said, well, you better go see a dermatologist or a neurologist or a cardiologist or an orthopedic surgeon. That's what I thought you should do. And it was only after I got myself better trained in menopause that I realized that these were classic menopause symptoms, and they were just very variable from woman to woman. And so I began to realize this was vastly underrepresented in OBGYN training, and that I didn't know any menopause-trained clinicians in my whole part of the country. And so I started a practice in 2008 that was, I gave up the obstetrics because there were plenty of other people in Princeton, New Jersey who could deliver babies. And I said, I'm going to have a practice that's devoted just to gynecology and to the parts of gynecology that aren't really getting adequately addressed. And it wasn't just menopause. It was adolescence. It was geriatrics. It was cancer survivors. People that were kind of marginalized in an OBGYN practice, trans patients. In 2008, people really had no idea how to deal with trans patients. So it's been a beautiful thing to develop this practice, which ultimately served about 30,000 women in the region and was sort of almost a victim of its own success. And to really dig into menopause education and then ultimately to mentoring other physicians all around the country in terms of menopause. The way the sexual health evolved was actually almost as a subset of menopause. So once I had trained a lot of physicians and hired other people to develop a lot of menopause care, I noticed that the one part of menopause that patients were still ashamed to talk about and clinicians were poorly trained in was sexual health, including sexual pain. Women would come in and say things to me like, I'm broken and I think it's just me. Something's wrong with me, but I don't have any libido, or it hurts when I have intercourse, or I have terrible pain when I have an orgasm. And I know there's just something weird about me, but you have to fix me because men want to have sex and my partner expects me to be there sexually for him. So I thought, okay, I know how to fix the sexual pain in some patients, right? It could be vaginal dryness from lack of estrogen, or it could be vulvodynia. It could be trauma from a difficult vaginal delivery. It could be endometriosis. A lot of the things you see, right? And I thought, okay, I know how to fix some of that. But when I really paused and I really listened to these women, they were really telling me much more than simply that they had pain. They were telling me that they had shame, that they were embarrassed, that they weren't the vital, robust, sexually active partners that their mostly male partners wanted them to be. But the same held true for my same-sex couples, really. So I started digging into what was behind their shame and their embarrassment, and what are the forces that shape and inform who women think they're supposed to be sexually. And man, did I uncover a treasure trove of factors. And that's how I came up with this concept of the bedroom gap and did a TED talk about what happens to sex in midlife and then wrote this book. So that kind of leads, I guess, into helping your listeners understand what the bedroom gap is, really. Should I say that?
No, that's perfect. I mean, you went through so much information that I think is so valuable to our listeners, right? I mean,
yeah,
the fact that women's health is misunderstood, is not well managed. We don't have the research for it about what is the right way to treat it. And also one of the things that you mentioned, which also overlaps for why I started seeing pelvic pain patients, was there's so much shame. Why is there shame that somebody has pain or they have painful intercourse or whatever it may be? And I'm sure you already know this, but for our listeners, just a reminder that the word pudendal, as in pudendal nerve block, comes from the Latin origin of the word shameful.
Shame. Yeah.
Pudenda means shame, and that persists not just in history, but even now where we feel uncomfortable speaking about it. So you're doing a great job, I think, speaking about something that is also very intimate for a lot of people, which is aging and sexual experiences, right? Postmenopausal
exactly.
Sex lives, which a lot of people, you know, also don't feel comfortable speaking about.
But honestly, that shame comes even for young women. I mean, you and I have treated young women who have shame, have painful sex or can't have sex, maybe because they were assaulted. Maybe they were abused as children. Maybe they had an episiotomy that went wrong, you know, many reasons. And they carry that shame for their entire sexual life. And so I think people like you and I really have it should be a mandate that we work deeply with them to try to uncover whether these are only biological or anatomical or nerve reasons, or whether there are psychological or social or sociocultural reasons as well. So we say that, you know, a lot of medicine and especially in the pain field, there's a biopsychosocial etiology to a lot of pain, including sexual pain. And that's really what I'm saying is we owe it to our patients to dig a little deeper and understand where the shame is coming from and maybe where the pain is coming from, because they're often very linked. And as you had said, many patients internalize the belief that they're just supposed to be having pain. That's part of having sex. That's part of being a woman. And I call BS on that. I say women should have the right to sexual pleasure. Forget sexual pain. I mean, they should have a right to pain-free sex. That should be number one. But number two should be Why can't we advocate for even pleasure to be something that women could feel is their due? Why does sex have to be for men and for male pleasure, which is an androcentric model of sex that's been around for like 4,000 years at least?
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. So tell us about your book, The Bedroom Gap. How do you define that gap in your book?
Sure. So the gap is quite broad. It's really the difference in expectations and abilities between sexual partners, most commonly between men and women, that can occur at any time in life. A 20-year-old man and a 20-year-old woman can have differences in their sexual expectations and even their sexual abilities. Just because you're 20 and not menopausal doesn't mean you can orgasm or you know how to orgasm or you know how to pleasure yourself. And I found that there's a lot of pressure in the 20 to 30-year-old group and a lot of bedroom gap or sexual discrepancy issues between partners in the 20 to 30-year-old group. But again, going back to menopause, I found that as women age and their ovaries stop making estrogen, we call that menopause, the physiologic changes in the vagina and vulva are not user-friendly. When the estrogen is cut off and vagina and vulva don't have the benefit of estrogen, we lose collagen. The collagen we have is actually replaced by a poor quality collagen that's not as flexible. And we lose blood vessels, and we need those for health. We need those for moisture. So this is why, Alopi, if you're atrophic, if you're devoid of estrogen in the genitals, you are almost guaranteed to have discomfort because you can't make the moisture, even if mentally you are turned on. So this leads to a lot of sexual discomfort. Probably 70% or more of menopausal women, so menopause meaning from when there's no periods for a year until death, really, so like a third of your life, I would say about 70% at least of women experience that. But they suffer in silence because women are taught not to talk about those things. Mm-hmm. Doctors are not trained to ask. And many doctors, frankly, don't prioritize sexual health as part of overall health.
Right.
And others are diminish women's pain. You know, we know this from pain everywhere in the body, right? Women with chest pain are more likely to be diagnosed with a heart attack than men with chest pain. Like, on what planet is that normal? So sorry. So I think that we have a bit of a don't ask, don't tell situation here and women suffering. And the really sad thing is it's really treatable. It's crazy easy to treat that. You know, vaginal estrogen is cheap. It's available. It's been studied for 50-something years. It's safe for every female with a vagina on the planet.
Right.
There, it is safe for cancer patients. It's safe for cancer survivors and thrivers. It's safe for people with a family history of cancer. There, you cannot find me someone for whom it's contraindicated in. So we know it's safe. We know it's available. One big problem is that doctors stopped prescribing it in 2002 based on a flawed study of systemic estrogen. So they confused that with vaginal estrogen, just lumped it in as the same thing and stopped prescribing it. Women also heard about that 2002 study, the Women's Health Initiative, assumed that all estrogen is dangerous. Not true. Vaginal estrogen and systemic estrogen have very different safety profiles. And so as a result, we have vaginal estrogen being used by only a tiny fraction of the people who would benefit.
Right.
And as I said, it's a cheap, safe, easy fix
right.
for probably the most common cause of sexual pain among women.
Yeah.
And I'm not being a Debbie Downer. I'm saying this to energize people listening, saying, go advocate for yourself. If you're having vaginal dryness and intercourse is not comfortable and you've tried lube, well, if you haven't tried lube, please use lube. It's so crazy safe and inexpensive. But if it's still uncomfortable, please go see a gynecologist and demand that they address this. And if they're not comfortable with vaginal estrogen, you shouldn't walk out of that room. You should run out of that room and find a clinician, whether it's an internist, a pelvic pain specialist. I mean, would you prescribe vaginal estrogen? Dr. Patel, would you?
So I don't in my clinical practice right now, but I have spoken to other pain physicians in rural areas that do. But for now, I am thankfully in an urban area where women are able to get access to estrogen. But I know it's something that not all women across the country have access to.
Okay. And I would beg you to not deprive someone who can't otherwise get it, because Absolutely. Sometimes they can't. You have to realize that sometimes their OBGYN or their primary has not evolved past 2002. And
that's true.
That your success as a pain doc could be markedly improved if you can help them in that field. I you know, you're such a great physician. I know you know this already, but I think you could underestimate how backwards some clinicians are. Because I get to see this every day in my practice. People who've gone to 5 or 6 clinicians and no one will give them vaginal estrogen. And remember, we now have the black box warning that was on vaginal estrogen is now removed. That's something I fought for years and was lucky enough to go to the FDA and help get that removed. So that was a big victory.
Yes. And thank you to you and many of the giants in the field who were able to work on that, because I know that was a landmark moment for women for decades to come. What do you think clinicians are missing? So as we know, and we've been talking about, menopause does not just fall on the gynecologist, right? That's what we traditionally believe, that it's just the gynecologist that can deal with menopause. It has biological symptoms, psychological, physical symptoms, social symptoms, and impact on their social structure. There's just so many things that it can impact. What can we as clinicians across the healthcare system do to help treat menopause? And with that, the ripple effect of what happens with menopause.
So you do not have to become a menopause expert. I mean, my fantasy is that all physicians have to once a year just take a 1-hour course to remind themselves of the breadth of menopausal symptoms, that it affects every single subspecialty, so that if they have a woman with frozen shoulder, they don't just say, I'll give you a steroid injection or I'll operate on your shoulder. They say, hold on, you know, you're 58. Let's get you on a little estrogen patch, see if the symptoms improve. Guess what? They almost always do. And then you may not need this surgery. So that'd be a fantasy. But until that could happen, I would love every clinician, you know, to at least understand when they look at a woman anywhere between 35 and 65, because for some women, remember, menopause happens inadvertently very, very early, either an immune disorder, or they have to have surgery and their ovaries are removed. There are lots of ways that women go through menopause before 51 and a half, which is the average age for natural menopause. So I'd love it if clinicians would look at through a gendered lens. Mm-hmm. And before they quickly say, oh, you're teary, you're anxious, you're tired, you need an antidepressant, they say, you know, I think you may need someone other than me, but to really think about this as potentially perimenopause or menopause. Or if they're comfortable learning, to go ahead and learn. I mean, you can get trained in menopause pretty easily.
Right.
And it's so, you know, it just depends how much people are willing to say, gosh, women are 50% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine if a dentist didn't know about cavities, or a dentist didn't know something that happened to 50% of their population, right? They'd be not a very good dentist. So I do think clinicians of all specialties need to think about this a little bit and just realize that estrogen deficiency, whether it happens at 51 or 45 or 53, has massive impacts on the brain, on our cardiovascular risk, on bones, on teeth, on eyes, on ears, and just be able to give that a little thought. There are many states now that are going to mandate menopause education to recertify as for licensure. So I think things are beginning.
I love that. It's such a necessary shift in the way that we treat women's health. Women's health is not just bikini medicine, as we've kind of seen. It's not just the breast and their pelvic area. It's so much more than that. And the book, The Bedroom Gap, also speaks about the dynamics outside the clinic, about a partner and their expectations, their marriage, and societal narratives. Can you talk a bit more about that? How does that affect postmenopausal women?
Yeah, very, very much. I mean, to be quite honest, the bedroom gap itself can be really relationship wrecking. I mean, I've had patients come in tears because for 8 years they haven't had sex because they've had a totally treatable problem, but nobody recognized it or gave them vaginal estrogen, or nobody linked their pain and endometriosis to the fact that they weren't having sex. I mean, obviously someone like you would be so perfect for that person to do a good history and figure it out. But sometimes they've been dismissed so quickly that they keep it all inside and then they just stop having sex. And after X number of months or years, their partner looks elsewhere or leaves them or has an affair. And then they come to me in tears saying, you know, I guess this could not have been prevented. And the truth is it often could. So critical is communication between partners about sex. This sounds so obvious, but you'd be shocked how rarely couples talk about sex. They talk about a car needing repair, college tuition payments, someone's mother moving in. They talk about everything in a long-term relationship, but they say, no, we never talk about sex. We just do it. And now we can't really do it. So I just roll over or he sleeps in another room. And it's tragic to think that this could be helped with something as simple as communication. But our society teaches women not to talk about sex, so, and not to even know their body parts and not to masturbate and not to do sort of basic things that can lead to a comfort with your body and a comfort asking your partner, hey, that's uncomfortable, but you know what I really love is this. So The Bedroom Gap, the book, helps women to begin those conversations, to begin that very first conversation for many women, which is something along the lines of, you know, I've noticed things are not as great sexually for us anymore. And I have to say, I think part of it may be me, but I'd love to work on this together. Or I'd love for you to think about maybe whether you'd be okay if I bought some lube or a toy because I'm 58 and I feel like I need something a little more now. I mean, things like that. So many women tell me, oh, I could never say that to a partner. So I felt like before I try to get the whole world on vaginal estrogen, I need to make sure that couples are able to talk and communicate. So The Bedroom Gap as a book talks about what happens to us as we age, but also about how we can repair or prevent these problems, really at any age, just with communication. In addition, you know, you can't put it all on your clinicians.
100%. And we can't put it all on just the women, right? And you mentioned so many important points, which is sex is not a one-way street. You can't clap with one hand, as they say. Like, you need partners to have an equal seat at the table, so to speak, about communicating. You can't just be, like you said, just the woman kind of rolls over and just lies there. So the partners also have a responsibility. And I'm assuming this is a long-term partnership, right? Obviously, there can also be...
But we talk about hookup sex, and we talk about how to date online and how to ask for what you want. We talk about how to restart a relationship after infidelity. That's not easy.
Oh, wow.
How to get back into sex after chronic illness or a heart attack. That's frightening for people. What do you do if you're a cancer survivor? What do you do if you're the partner of a cancer survivor? These are awkward questions that often don't get addressed in the exam room and that often don't get communicated between partners. So I tried to pick out some of these, we'll call them marginalized groups or under the radar situations, and give people some tools to begin to advocate. Because we know that couples who resume being sexually active live longer, have lower blood pressure, lower anxiety, lower depression, less feeling of isolation. Like, there are longevity benefits. And so I want that for people. I mean, you can take all the supplements you want in the world, but if you're lonely or you're have a long-term relationship, but you're not intimate. And by the way, sex doesn't have to mean penis and vagina just because our society sort of defines it as that. And, you know, Bill Clinton defined it as that. You can redefine sex for yourself. If you have a bad vulvodynia or pelvic pain and sex redefines as just cuddling or kissing or oral sex or whatever, that's wonderful. If you're happy and your partner's happy, done. We're done. We solved it. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm pushing people to go have penis and vagina sex and it's all or nothing. Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I love that. That's so true. We have a lot of work to do. And I feel like we've come a long way thanks to people like you And we have a long way to go because though these are challenging topics of conversation that we have to start having them, including with our partners, right? So it's not just falling on the woman, so to speak. So kind of thinking about what is your definition of success when treating sexual pain postmenopausally? Is it based on their agency with having sexual intercourse, they're having an increased desire to having sexual intercourse? What do you define as success?
I think that's, I mean, you're really on it. And I think you should keep talking because you're being so eloquent and so evolved and in your response. So success is you as the patient, you get to define that. And the way I define success is if you're my patient, and you tell me success is for my partner and I, penis and vagina sex with orgasms for both of us 4 times a week, then that's the goal that we aim for. But, you know, that may not be achievable if you've had cancer and radiation therapy and da 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 da, and the opening of the vagina is the size of a pencil. We may need to have a real honest talk about the fact that I can't create a vagina. I can't undo that, and that's not going to happen. But what I can do is teach you about intimacy, about ways to orgasm without penis and vagina sex, or about, you know, the fact that, you know, we're going to reframe the definition of sex, and we're going to have to teach your partner to reframe that. Maybe he has absolute incurable erectile dysfunction, and then we need to explain that, you know, no matter all the meds we've tried, the pumps we've tried, that's not going to be part of our definition. But success could still be something else, you know. So right. I definitely, success is patient dependent, and every patient has to define with me. We come together as a team and we define what that is. It's like when I do weight management and people go on GLP-1s, it's not necessarily for everyone. Success is losing 30 pounds. It's what's the weight that gets you healthy. So I think with sexual pain, you probably have a similar thing. You know, there are some people you're not going to make pain-free, but you're going to aim for success as something that they can live with or accept.
Absolutely true. I love that. And as we wrap up, I have two more questions. So for our clinicians that are listening to this, so healthcare providers in general, what is something that you wish clinicians would ask their female patients, but they may not usually do it?
Yeah, I think a simple two-part sentence, and I didn't really time it, but I'm going to guess it takes about 5 to 10 seconds. And depending on the answer, I'll tell you why I want them to just ask this. I want them to think of sex as one of the pillars of health. And I get a lot of eye rolls from clinicians because they're like, no, sleep, nutrition, movement, and social connectivity. Those are the classic pillars of health. And I'm the first to accept that, yes. But if you'll put sexual health in there as a tiny little fifth pillar, and just do me the favor as any clinician to say, are you sexually active and is it comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
If that patient says anything other than yes, a hell yes, and yes, in which case you've just finished. That's it. You don't really need to do more. Or are you satisfied? I guess could be a third thing. But if the answer is no, or a hum, or I don't know, I've never talked to anyone about that, then I think you really owe it to that patient, even if you're not trained. If you're not a sex therapist, you're not a gynecologist, you're not a menopause, that's all right. Just to say, hey, thank you for sharing that. I'm a kidney specialist, so I know I'm not the best person to help you with this, but I want you to know I think it's important to your overall health. And even if you're on dialysis, I think you should try to find sexual joy as part of your overall joy in life. And I do know there's a website called AASECT.com where you can find sex therapists, or you may know a gynecologist in town who really loves this, or a urologist for your husband or whatever. And I would really urge you to make the time to go and check that out and give it a little time, because I think it's really important. I mean, that whole interaction could take less than 2 minutes. And you may even say, oh, darn it, I am so behind. I can't, please forgive me. But do you mind if I just shoot you a little email in the patient portal, a little text in the patient portal with a couple ideas? Because I really think this is an important part of your health.
Right.
Goodbye. You did a great job.
I love that. And it's so true. We can even like add it. A lot of our notes are automated with our signatures, and you can always add resources there. I put some resources there. So for patients who go back and online and see their notes, they can automatically see those resources. And last question, if readers can take away one idea from this book that we will eventually read, but what is that idea that you want listeners and readers to take away?
Well, I ultimately want The Bedroom Gap to be read by men and women,
yeah,
gay and straight, all ages. But I think the women that will most likely pick it up, the humans, will be women in their 40s to 60s, which is fine and wonderful. And maybe I need to write a different book that men will be excited by the cover and be like, this one's for me, you know. But the reason I think they'll mostly read it is they're struggling and with their own sexual identity. And they've mostly grown up in an era where their moms and grandmoms didn't tell them to have sexual agency or mm-hmm. to communicate. So I guess my one idea is that if you're reading the book and you skim it and you close it and someone says, what's the one thing you're going to do now differently? It's that you're going to reframe your idea that sex is for him or for mm-hmm. your partner. Sex is for you both. And that you have a right to comfortable and pleasurable sex. You have that right. That's not a luxury. You know how women say guilty pleasure? Did you notice that only women say guilty pleasure?
That's true.
Think about why that is. And why, by the way, is it a guilty pleasure to eat a cookie or I love black licorice? Why is it a guilty pleasure for me to have a piece of black licorice? Like, I eat healthy all day long. So we do this to ourselves and we feel that sex is not for us, not for our pleasure. It's a service. So I would like women to stop thinking like that and to start thinking that it's theirs, it's their right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously a second idea would be one way to begin to have it is to communicate with your partner and your clinician and just find a way to do that. And if you need to reach me, they can find me at mariasophoclesmd.com. On my website or on Instagram, same thing, at mariasophoclesmd.com. Or they could look at the TED Talk as a starter to begin mm-hmm. to rehash some of what we spoke about, TED Talk Maria Sophocles. And I think these are simple little ways that they can feel empowered to begin this journey. Thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you for coming on this podcast and looking forward to the book.
Good. Well, I'll make sure you have it in your hands really soon.
We would love to hear your thoughts. Visit our Instagram at The Female Pain Docs for more content. Send us an email at thefemalepaindocs@gmail.com if you have any topics in particular you would like us to discuss.
You can also visit our website at www.thefemalepaindocs.com. See you next time.